So I was asked, do you really want to leave that thing from the standard model up there? And my answer is yes. I was sort of sitting looking from the back and noticed that Sean had actually put up this picture. And the reason why I'm interested in this picture is because it's talking about the vacuum. And it's in particular talking about when the vacuum is stable and when it's not stable. So you've been seeing about the vacuum from the perspective of field theory in the standard model, but in this course, we've been talking about the vacuum with respect to gravity, because gravity sees energy, and therefore gravity is actually interested in what the vacuum is. So crudely speaking, if we're talking about a stable vacuum, this would be an example. That's something where our vacuum, and I'm imagining it just carries on getting big, the energy carries on getting bigger and bigger the further away you go from that minimum. So an example of an unstable vacuum would be something like this. Because clearly, if you're sitting at this local stationary point, if you make a small perturbation, your field runs off. So that's an example of a tachyon. This is an example of metastability. It's where something looks like it's stable in the short run, but in fact, if you stand back like we are, looking at the potential, we see it's not a global minimum. So that's the story of today's lecture. We're going to be talking about metastability of vacua that are metastable. We're going to talk about how we calculate the half-life or how we calculate the probability of decay. And we do that via a trick, if you like. It's a calculational tool called an instanton, where we go to Euclidean time and find solutions. And the reason that is such a useful tool from a perspective, if we're thinking about tunneling in our universe, is that, of course, we know from what we've done during this course that we can do gravity with Euclidean time. So if our tunneling solution is something in Euclidean time in flat space, that means that we can say, aha, but I can import that into gravity because I know how to deal with Euclidean gravity. And indeed, I also know that if I want to calculate actions of solutions, that's particularly straightforward in Euclidean gravity. So that's the overview, if you like, of what we're about to do in today's lecture. So what I'm going to spend most of the time on is being reasonably explicit about the sort of classic calculations from the late 70s and early 80s of Coleman and collaborators. So I'll just give you the references for those. So in this, Coleman had a sequence of papers actually addressing, quantum mechanical tunneling, or rather tunneling in quantum field theory, where he calculated the sort of leading order contribution to this amplitude for vacuum decay. So it's something that we call a non-perturbative process. In the sense that we can't just get it by making small fluctuations from our initial state that have the smaller the fluctuation, the smaller the energy of the of the actual perturbation. Here we have an inherent sort of jump, if you like, in terms of our of the energy of our solution. And as we will see, just like the domain wall, which is, I called it a non-perturbative solution because we couldn't shift it and get it to either one vacuum or the other, we'll see something very similar here. In fact, we're going to use the domain wall as our kind of analytical tool to estimate some of the tunneling rates. So let's just recall what we mean by tunneling. So if we are classical, so I have a great picture of this of someone on a snowboard trying to actually go through a brick wall. Classically, we know we can't go through a brick wall. It's a genuine barrier. Unless we have enough energy to jump over the top, we're stuck on one side of the wall. So classically, this is our energy, and this is our barrier. Classically, we have no transmission because we don't have enough energy to get over the wall. Quantum mechanically, on the other hand, we've now got a wave function. For sure, most of the wave function gets reflected. But we do now have an amplitude for transmission. Which, if we use the Schrödinger equation and solve it with the correct boundary conditions at each edge of the potential, we can find an exact expression for our square well potential. So our wave function, when our energy is less than the potential energy in a region, all that we have is an exponential tail. So our wave function has this exponentially decaying property, which means that by the other side of a barrier, as long as it's not infinite, either infinitely long or infinitely high, we've still got a little bit of a tail of our wave function at the other side, and that kind of emerges, giving us back our sort of oscillatory psi. So this probability is, roughly speaking, it's an exponential factor, thinking of this exponential tail, and it's given by this imaginary frequency here, omega, times the distance. So this omega d is the overall potential barrier. So a more general barrier has this characteristic behavior. You just sort of integrate how much of a barrier there is, and that gives you your exponential suppression. So how do we now think about this a bit more generally? This is just to motivate the expression that I want to get. So I'm going to do a kind of stationary phase type of approximation, but here I'm going to, suppose I haven't approximated anything yet, but So here's my approximation. This is of order h bar, so I kind of look at this piece here. And so here, we have a real solution for psi for V equals zero, but under the barrier, psi is now imaginary. So that's kind of, you know, different way of seeing how we get our exponential tail. We're kind of just looking at the phase of the wave function. When it's real, we have sort of real propagation of particles. When it's imaginary, our wave function is decaying, and we have this sort of not real particle. So now I just want to just step slightly to the side. And just think about what our classical equations of motion are for a particle in a potential well. So ultimately, I'm going to kind of try and link this back into that lowercase psi over there as something that's a sort of behaving. Here, we're sort of thinking about things behaving effectively classically. So here I'm imagining I've got a potential well of height delta V, and I have some little ball bearing or marble or something that I allow to drop. So the ball drops, it picks up kinetic energy because it's dropping, so the kinetic energy is going to be given by that delta V, and then it's going to move along the bottom to the other side. So if I ask what the integral of the square root of delta 2 delta V is dx, so here I know that x dot squared is 2 delta V, so this is actually the integral of 2 delta V dt. I'll call it tau now because I want to distinguish it from the other side. So at the moment, I'm just doing a bit of manipulation, but I can then relate one of those delta Vs to a half x dot squared. So what I've got here is something that looks a bit like a Lagrangian, or a Hamiltonian in this case. But if I now think of my standard Lagrangian, and I send my time to Euclidean time, then I see that I've got something that looks rather similar. So here, so I've sort of taken a few steps that are probably going to look slightly puzzling. Here I've said, this is my Lorentzian Lagrangian. I Euclideanize it. And then what I've now got is, from a Euclidean perspective, a Lagrangian with the opposite sign of a potential. So, in some sense, the motion of my Lorentzian system, I can think of as motion of a Euclidean system with an inverted potential. So although for the case of our Schrödinger particle, we can solve exactly, we know exactly what our transmission probability is, this exponent here, e to the 2 omega d, is given as an integral over the barrier of the height of the barrier. And we can express that integral through the barrier, of the height of the barrier, instead as an integral of a Euclidean particle moving in an inverted potential well. So if we didn't have such a nice shape, or if we're, instead of being in 1+1 dimensions, we're in 3+1 dimensions, instead of quantum mechanics, we've got quantum field theory, our amplitude for decay in general is given by the exponential of the Euclidean action. So over h bar, if we don't set h bar equal to 1. So SB, is the action of a Euclidean solution . So the Euclidean action between the exit, the entry and exit points, or the different vacua. So we have this. This is our sort of classic metastable state. Quantum mechanically, we sort of feel this, and think of this as an alpha particle in a nucleus. Quantum mechanically, we feel it should be able to tunnel out. How do we calculate that? Well, we invert the potential. And then we solve for the Euclidean equations of motion, which will our little billiard ball will roll to an exit point and back again. and we calculate the action of that Euclidean solution. So this is so this Euclidean solution was called the bounce. And we kind of tend to write our action as SB. So it's a very nice visual, sort of intuitive description, but it's really just a tool. There's no kind of reality to that Euclidean particle motion. It's actually just a tool to calculate what's happening in the real-time picture. You're trying to solve a real-time problem, but it happens to be a lot easier to do it if you go to Euclidean time and solve some classical Euclidean equations. So your leading order description for this process is like a classical solution. So the example that we're looking at is called false vacuum decay. So the false vacuum is one of these sort of metastable vacua. We call it a false vacuum because it looks like a vacuum locally. If we expand around this point, locally, we get some sort of particle spectrum. We certainly have a massive particle if we quantize around that point. What we also pick up, though, is a very small tail or a small imaginary component that corresponds to the tail of our wave function, if you're thinking about it quantum mechanically, having sort of leaked out into the new potential well and wanting to roll down to the new minimum. So we call it a false vacuum because it looks like a vacuum. It acts like a vacuum, but it's not actually a real vacuum because it can decay. So our model is going to be a scalar field. And we're going to model our V for the moment by our double well potential just set slightly skew. So here we have something that looks roughly like a double well, but with a very slight tilt, so that one minimum is just slightly lower than the other. So our left vacuum, phi is minus eta, V is epsilon. This is our false vacuum. And phi equals plus eta, V is naught, is our true vacuum. So we expect this false vacuum to be metastable. And we are taking our slightly sort of naive, potentially naive intuition from the simple particle in a potential well, and we're going to use that as a technique to calculate the tunneling amplitude for this field theory. So I just want to stress this is kind of a tool. It's a calculational technique for finding these amplitudes. So in Euclidean time, our wave equation becomes a Euclidean wave equation. We just swap the various signs. And so we're looking for a solution to this Laplace sort of Poisson equation. So the reason that Coleman initially considered this particular potential that had just a very tiny discrepancy between the two vacua relative to the potential barrier was so that you should, you know, if you think back to our domain wall discussion, if you look at this, you see this term was what cropped up in our tangent solution. This was our domain wall. We've got this epsilon here, which we're thinking of as small. And then, okay, we're sitting in four Euclidean dimensions, but nonetheless, it's looking very similar to the domain wall problem. So we have an approximate solution. In terms of a variable, that is the distance, if this is our Euclidean time, this is our real Lorentzian flat space radial coordinate, our approximate solution is like a bubble, which is really sort of thick because it's one of these walls. But the idea is that we have something that looks roughly like this. Outside, we have the false vacuum. Inside, we have the true vacuum. And then we have the wall that interpolates between the two. So at the moment, that's sort of an approximation. We have to check that this is a self-consistent solution, but we'll do that after we've kind of calculated the radius of this solution here. So I've called this rho naught. So we have a rapid transition across that wall. So that's the setup from the four-dimensional Euclidean perspective. We want to calculate our Euclidean action. So that's the integral of a half of the gradient terms plus the potential. This is roughly the integral of a half phi prime squared plus v, where prime is d by d rho. And that is roughly the tension of the wall times the area. Plus actually a divergent piece, which is the false vacuum outside the bubble. So this is, if you like, the false vacuum energy. So what we really need to get the energy of the solution, we subtract off the background. So we need the action of the false vacuum. So we can truncate it. We're going to, you know, it's basically the same as this. This would be r pi squared over 2 times r capital R to the fourth minus rho naught to the fourth. So if we find the difference, this is what we get. So let's just pause and just think about what this means. We're saying that we form a bubble. It costs us energy to make the wall. The wall is quite locally extremely energetic, but very thin. It has an energy per unit area sigma, and we're making a bubble of wall, so that costs us the area of the wall times the wall's energy per unit area. So you can think of this as the cost of making a wall. On the other hand, if we make a transition from our false vacuum to the true vacuum, we've gained all the energy inside the bubble that was in the false vacuum. So we've gone from the inside of this bubble having a vacuum energy epsilon to it being completely in vacuum, and therefore we've gained energy. So this is what we gain. From going to the vacuum. So a good analogy when thinking about what happens in this process is to think about boiling water. It's only an analogy because it's a totally classical process, boiling water. But boiling water is an example of a first order phase transition. It's where the order parameter describing your, your system has a discontinuity. So when you go through a phase transition that's first order, you typically, it propagates by forming bubbles. So you get bubbles of steam forming inside the water. Now, if the bubble is too small, essentially there's been, you know, we know how the ratio of surface area to volume, it's cost too much to make the wall relative to the energy you've gained by making the vacuum transition. So your bubble collapses in. If the bubble is too big, sure, you get a nice payback from the change in the vacuum, but the overall cost of the process of turning all of that internal bubble into true vacuum, that's sort of a lot of space to have gone over the potential barrier. So it's just a bit too big, whereas there's a just right size where the cost of the making the wall plus the payback from the vacuum is just at the right amount that makes it sort of feasible. It's just on the bubble is just big enough that it doesn't re-collapse, but it's not so big that it's costly to form. So it's that kind of the sort of Goldilocks type of bubble. So since our solution is a stationary point, we found it via our sort of standard Lagrangian methods, that means that it has to be stationary with respect to rho naught. So what was neat about what Coleman did was to say, well, I know that this whole system is really four-dimensional, it's continuous, it's a solution for a field theory phi, but most of the complication of the scalar field is really just in giving me the detailed structure of this bubble wall between the two vacua. But the essential physics of the bubble is just in its size. And so all I do is I kind of get rid of all this complication. I sort of see how the field organizes itself into this bubble wall, but the only really physical parameter is the radius of the bubble wall. So I'm going to differentiate my action with respect to rho naught and demand that it's stationary. So this gives me a size, a characteristic size for my bubble wall. So notice that the size is proportional to 1 over epsilon, so that rho naught is big. So remember that I wrote down the approximation for the Tench function. So this makes us happy because our Tench approximation required rho naught to be large. So we've now got a measure of internal consistency with this analytic approximation. Of course, it goes without saying that we can solve the system numerically and just compute all these things straight out. It's simply that here we're trying to gain some insight by looking for analytic descriptions. So I then calculate my action, IB. And my amplitude or probability for decay is just the exponent of minus IB. So that's the calculation for the leading order estimate for the probability of decay in quantum field theory of the false vacuum in this particular example, the potential up there. So once our bubble is formed, it's real then, and we can find its evolution by returning to Lorentzian time. So our domain wall, remember, the bubble was at rho squared equaled rho naught squared, but of course rho squared was tau squared minus, sorry, tau squared plus r squared. So I go back to Lorentzian time and I find a hyperboloid, which was in fact kind of what we had for our gravitating domain wall. So we have our picture of a bubble kind of nucleating, suddenly appearing at t equals zero, and then expanding outwards at constant acceleration. So that's the picture for vacuum decay just within field theory. But of course, we know that vacuum energy gravitates. So we can calculate the amplitude for vacuum decay, including gravity, by finding Euclidean gravitational solutions. So that's how we do it. That's how we include gravity. Our false vacuum here has a constant energy, and so that's equivalent to a cosmological constant. And so what we need to do is we now say our bubble separates flat space, which is our true vacuum, from de Sitter space, which is our false vacuum. So it's really not very different at all, except we're not, our space-time coordinates, t and r, are no longer going along for the ride. Our geometry has to be de Sitter in the false vacuum. So de Sitter space, Euclidean de Sitter space, remember we saw that Lorentzian de Sitter space was a hyperboloid. So Euclidean de Sitter space looks like a sphere. We always have this translation, hyperboloid for Lorentz is a sphere for Euclidean. So we have our Euclidean de Sitter space simply being a sphere of radius L. So here, L is given by the cosmological constant. pi dimensions. Should be 8 pi g epsilon, I think, not lambda. So that is my Euclidean space. And so remember that what we do when we think about putting a wall, we now use this idea of our bubble wall. And so we've sort of seen this in earlier this week where I talked about the Israel equations. So here is our de Sitter space. Here is our Minkowski space-time. And so all we do is we simply cut our de Sitter sphere at some radius. This is going to be our bubble. And replace it with a segment of flat space. So that is geometrically what our instanton is. So we've taken the bubble that we had, can't find the picture. We've taken our flat space bubble, and outside in the false vacuum, the only difference by adding gravity is that our false vacuum now curves round on itself and forms the de Sitter sphere. So this is what our instanton looks like gravitationally. So remember, a question at last.
The choice for the false vacuum to be the Sitter and the real vacuum to be Minkowski is kind of arbitrary, right? You could have chosen the real to be at the Sitter and the other to be Minkowski.
Well, not really, because Minkowski has the lower energy.
Lower than at the Sitter?
Yeah, because the Sitter has a positive cosmological constant. So from the perspective of drawing this thing, this is our de Sitter space with a positive lambda, and this is our vacuum with zero lambda.
I mean, you could have chosen the false vacuum to be Minkowski and the lower one to be anti de Sitter.
Oh, yes. Sorry, yes, absolutely correct. And indeed, in Coleman's paper, Coleman de Lucia's paper, they consider all cases. The reason I'm doing this one is because it's kind of the most intuitively natural, this notion that zero vacuum energy is the real vacuum. And so therefore our false vacuum has to have positive energy. It's also nice because I can draw exact pictures. You know, flat space-time is flat and de Sitter is round. I can't draw a hyperboloid because the hyperboloid, a two-dimensional hyperboloid needs four Euclidean dimensions to do an embedding picture in. So in this one, I can at least draw pictures that directly correspond to the equations that we're solving, to the Euclidean Einstein equations. So remember that the Israel equations kind of use this boundary prescription where we have two manifolds. So this would be our M plus, this is our M minus. We've then got our boundary, which is sigma. And we have that, we have our gravitational action, we have our Gibbons-Hawking boundary terms, and then we have the energy density of the wall. So that was what I described earlier this week. So we're using that exact approach. And it's simply, you're quite right, you can go from any lambda to any slightly lower lambda. I've simply chosen lambda equals zero, true vacuum, lambda positive, false vacuum, for simplicity in this particular case. So what I need to do these Israel equations, remember it's delta K AB minus delta K HAB is 8 pi G, and then in this case, sigma HAB. So I need to calculate my extrinsic curvatures. So here for de Sitter, my normal is proportional to d by d chi. It's just that principal angle there. So my wall is at chi naught, and my k is simply homogeneous. It's just given in terms of the wall location. In Minkowski space, I've got flat space in polar coordinates. My wall is at rho naught, and rho naught has to equal L sine chi naught. And my K, so my N is d by d rho, and my K is just 1 over rho naught. So we kind of saw that that type of extrinsic curvature actually when we were doing the action for Schwarzschild. So if I now look at the Israel junction conditions, what is the jump in my K? I've got minus 2 over L cot chi naught plus 2 over rho naught, but that's given, I can sort of relate my rho naught to chi naught. So what I see now is that the Israel equations give me the radius of my bubble wall. So now I'm just going to give you the sort of key steps in the argument rather than sort of giving explicit derivations at this point. So I get my Euclidean action. L is, of course, related to epsilon. I have this this sort of relation that 1 over L squared is proportional to epsilon. So you can see there on the top line, I've got an L to the 6. So that's corresponding to 1 over epsilon cubed, which kind of agrees with the flat space case, so if I'm thinking of sending G to naught. And then, of course, the sigma, you can see I've got a sigma to the fourth on the top line. So, in fact, what I end up with if I send g to naught appropriately is it gives me the right flat space limit. So this is the Kullmann-DeLucia computation. And it gives me a half-life for vacuum decay. So why is this relevant? If we go back to that picture that was kindly left from the standard model, in this metastable state, and you see where he's drawn us, we're actually quite nicely plunked in this metastable state. If you calculate the Higgs coupling at let it run to very high energies, you kind of see that it starts to become negative. In other words, we're sitting down here, I don't know what's the scale, 10 to the 13 odd GV, something of that order, 13, 14, 15 orders of magnitude. It's big anyway. So our self-coupling of the Higgs becomes negative, and therefore our vacuum, technically speaking, is metastable. If you use this Kullmann-DeLucia calculation, what you put in all the numbers, you will find that the lifetime of our false Higgs vacuum is many orders of magnitude longer than the lifetime of the universe. So not to worry, you might think. Well, one of my sort of recent research projects has been to actually say, well, these calculations here are done with an extremely symmetric and smooth universe. We know that our universe, while symmetric, smooth, homogeneous, isotropic, etc., on large scales, on very small scales, it isn't. So what happens if you put homogeneities in from on the gravitational side of the argument? So rather than having de Sitter space, the one thing that you can do while still keeping very good calculational control is you can add a black hole. So instead of tunneling from, let's say, de Sitter to Minkowski space, you're tunneling from Schwarzschild de Sitter to Schwarzschild space-time. So you have a seed black hole and a remnant black hole. So within this thin wall approximation, you can still do the calculation. And it turns out that having a black hole can actually lower the action of the instanton. So in general, a big black hole won't have a big effect. But if you have a very small black hole, such as a primordial black hole, what that is doing is that is severely perturbing this smooth approximation of the Kullmann-DeLucia instanton on a very small scale. So you can calculate from the gravitational side, the semi-classical approach, you can calculate the instanton action with a black hole and compare the decay rate to Hawking evaporation. And so what myself and collaborators did was looked at the comparison of these two rates. So we looked at our branching ratio for decay through our branching ratio of decay to evaporation. And we see that we get, for primordial black holes of order about a kilogram, we start to get the decay rate being strongly preferred, being strongly dominant over evaporation. So this is actually not using a thin wall, not because to get a thin wall, the true Higgs potential just keeps going down. So to get a thin wall, you have to put a second minimum. Instead, what we did was solve it numerically for the actual Higgs potential. And so what you see is that by adding a black hole, you end up with sort of a bit of a problem if you've got primordial black holes and nothing else beyond the standard model. So it's particularly, I sort of particularly like talking about this topic because I think gravitational instantons are kind of interesting. It's an example where we're using a lot of the techniques we've developed throughout this course, where using this idea sort of gravitationally of these non-perturbative solutions, we're solving for field theories and gravity at the same time. We're doing this approximation with using the Gauss-Kadatze formalism. We're using what we've learned about actions, computing actions on the Euclidean side. And then in the end, we're kind of applying it to thinking about something that you would imagine had nothing to do with gravity at all, which is the stability or metastability of the Standard Model vacuum. So I think it's quite a nice example of how you can sort of bring, you know, all these different pieces of physics and put them together. So anyway, end of the course. Well done, everyone, for lasting to the end. I know today's lecture has been a challenge. There's a lot of sort of conceptual parts in it. Once you start to actually get towards papers in the literature, things do end up, you know, becoming just more difficult because typically you're using bits of knowledge from all over the place. But hopefully, at least, I've given you some idea of, you know, what's going on in at least formal gravitational research, and given you a few tools should you want to pursue them. Okay, thanks, guys.